Do you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome. Well, today we have a very meaty show for you. By that I mean a show in which we're going to focus on a lot of really important issues that have the potential to be hugely beneficial. And by this I mean those things that would be critical components of a good plan for elders or for seniors for the balance of their life. What are those items that should be on that list so that when you're in those latter stages, we'll call it the last third of your life, a good plan needs to contain certain things. And what are those core things that you know if I have these in place, I know I'm in pretty good shape? Susan, what do you think? Do you think this is relevant to our audience?
I believe this is very relevant to our audience. You know, we talk every week here about being prepared, making a plan. And why do we do that? We do that because we want to help you. We want to give you the tools that you need to avoid costly mistakes, to avoid mistakes that might alter your life or alter your family's future.
Yeah, and that's really what's at stake is, you know, whenever elder lawyers, as an elder lawyer, the way that I plan for clients is I think about, you know, what are the things that need to be in place to protect them for the balance of their life, to assure their needs are met, their comfort, et cetera. And then secondarily, you know, what are the things that need to be in place so that the legacy they're leaving, the objectives they have for their family over time can be fulfilled safely and securely. So both of those are important, and all too often, historically, estate planning lawyers, quote unquote, have tended to focus, in my opinion, unduly on, you know, what is that plan that's going to be in place after the client is dead. So I think clients, though, have both concerns in mind. Mm-hmm. I think they're concerned about the balance of their life, especially with long-term care being an issue, and then they're concerned about what happens thereafter. So we do this a lot at Cordell Planning Partners, and we think that we should take time every now and then on this show to circle back and talk about issues that we know are of urgency to some of you. Perhaps many of you are struggling with a problem that's developed among a family member or among others that where they need some sort of professional care. How do I pay for this? How do I plan for this? And then many of you yourselves may be on the threshold of those things. But here's the bottom line. The most important thing to do is to plan. Don't wait for an emergency. We call it vertical planning versus horizontal. So when you vertical plan, it means that there's pre-planning and you get to participate in that. Guess who's doing the planning when it's horizontal planning? It's not you.
It's not you. That's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, something's happened and maybe you've had a stroke, a heart attack, whatever, and someone else is struggling to put things together so that your needs and theirs can be met. So what I thought we might do today, Susan, is to kind of talk through what I think these core components would be. Mm-hmm. And we won't be able to provide a lot of explanation, but I want people to at least have a list in which they can identify, you know, what are those items?
A starting point. We all need to have a starting point. And I think sometimes fear is what keeps us from moving forward. Lack of knowledge keeps us from moving forward. And sometimes we just don't want to think about it. We think we're too busy. But it's not a scary process. And Joe's going to give us all kinds of really good tips. You're going to give us all kinds of really good tips on how we can get started with this.
And so when I think about this, I'm going to try to prioritize this list in terms of, if not importance, urgency, and probably urgency and importance. So what would be the first item? I think the first item should be an advanced care directive. An advanced care directive is a document by which you either declare to the world, you know, what decisions do you want be made regarding your health and your life at the end of life decisions? It can be what's called a living will. Many of you have heard of living wills. And that's, you know, again, a declaration of the world as opposed to a durable power of attorney for health care, where you're identifying someone that you're empowering to make those decisions for you. So those are kind of two different things. Mm-hmm. They can be in the same document, incidentally, and not unusually they are in Missouri. But I want you to understand there's a little bit of difference. But they're both intended to address that question of what do we do now? This person is incompetent. They can't make their own decisions. And now we need to decide, are we going to continue with a ventilator, for example? Mm-hmm. Or what about CPR? Or questions about, sometimes people will not even want analgesia or antibiotics. Sometimes they don't want artificial nutrition and hydration. I mean, these are important questions, and you don't want to saddle your family with the anxiety of having to struggle with those decisions, or perhaps even worse, it being made by a medical official.
So if you have a living will, then along with your durable power of attorney, the durable power of attorney must adhere to what you set out in your living will. Is that right?
Yeah, and it kind of gives that person direction.
Right.
But could a person proceed in the absence of a living will if they have a durable power of attorney for health care? Yeah, they could. They have the authority to make those decisions. But it's best to give them some guidance. I mean, kids often, you know, have a lot of doubt and discomfort for years after they've made some of these decisions because they weren't sure, right, is that really what mom wanted, right, or is that really what dad wanted?
Those are big emotional decisions,
yeah,
at a difficult time. And to have the comfort of your kids knowing that this is what mom or dad wanted, that is very comforting and freeing.
Yeah, it is. And a lot of us don't realize how much anxiety flows from having to make these calls, especially when you don't really know what mom or dad would have wanted. And you know, in a way, you're responsible for their death. I mean, mm-hmm, that sounds very grave, but I mean, you know, their condition may be terminal anyway, but the fact that you made this decision, you know, some struggle with that. So, you know, you can plan in advance. You can have a document created that will provide this detail. Let me discourage you from using what you're handed when you go into the hospital. I mean, the best place to get legal documents is not at your local hospital or other healthcare provider.
Right.
I mean, these are check-the-box sorts of forms, and granted, they're better than nothing. But the bottom line is you can have a very customized document that says what your values and your priorities are and can provide lots of specific information about how you feel about certain options. So I strongly encourage you, go to a lawyer who does a lot of work in this area and have them prepare something that you know reflects what you individually prefer. Now, I'm going to move on to the next item. The other item that I would have number two on my list in terms of urgency would probably be the durable power of attorney. Now, durable power of attorney, as opposed to durable power of attorney for health care, though they're under the same statute, still, they have separate provisions.
And two separate documents?
Yeah, two separate documents and two separate purposes. The durable power of attorney for health care, as the name implies, is focused on health-related matters. But the durable power of attorney deals with virtually everything else. Mm-hmm. In other words, financial decisions, legal decisions, all those important things that somebody would need to address in your absence. That's kind of what's represented by durable power of attorney. And when I say your absence, I'm talking about any sort of incompetency when you can't make decisions. It could be in the form of you had a stroke. It could be that there's severe dementia. It could occur in various ways. But it assures that somebody is there to carry on the decisions that need to be made about your life and your stuff, you know, legal matters. But think about your real estate. Think about bills that need to be paid. Consider deposits and withdrawals of bank accounts for various purposes that you would have done yourself. What about decisions about some of your planning for giving? You know, you can even have provisions where asset protection steps can be taken to allow you to qualify for Medicaid, for example. And it's funny, at the time that you perhaps first, you know, most urgently need Medicaid, often you're in a position where you can't decide to take those steps. And unless you have a document that very specifically grants that, mm-hmm, then no one else can either.
Wow. So now the question I have, one question I have is, can this be the same person that would be your durable power of attorney and your durable power of attorney for health care?
Yes, it can.
It can.
But often it's not, but it certainly can be. You know, you want a person who makes the decision about the durable power of attorney. You want them to be people who are very level-headed. They don't have to be a lawyer. They don't have to be an accountant. But you do want them to have really good judgment, in that they probably have, you know, a general familiarity with things of the world, so to speak, you know, financial matters and bills and making decisions about real estate generally, et cetera. Again, they don't have to be an expert, but it's really great to have somebody that has a whole lot of common sense and a whole lot of experience dealing with just these practical things.
And if you have the durable power of attorney set up, and let's say you are in a situation where you're going to require some paperwork to be filled out, how does it all work? Here's the they take the form to the hospital and say, okay, I'm the durable power of attorney. Does something have to kick in? What happens at that? Do they have to be declared incompetent or anything like that?
Well, those raise interesting points. And it does, it allows the person who's having this document created to make some important decisions. And it will hinge upon what they want. You can have what's called a springing durable power of attorney. And springing, kind of like the name, the word implies, mm-hmm. is that it comes into effect upon the occurrence of an event. And that event can be two doctors certify that you're incompetent. That's a common approach. I don't think it's the best approach. I think a better approach is to identify a panel of people that you empower to make that decision, maybe two or three. And these can be people that you truly trust completely. And if one's out of town, you still have two others, for example, that'd be available. So that's one issue, is do you want it to be in effect immediately?
Okay.
Now, here's a way to think about this. If I were, for example, to give you, Susan, a check that I had signed, a blank check virtually, now what could you take from me?
I could take a lot of money.
You
and
could.
And I could retire.
Well, I don't know actually that I have that much money in my account. However... But here's the difference. The reason I ask that question is, a lot of people do say, "Wow, you know, it means you can take a lot of money," and you can. And many people will answer, "Well, you can take everything." But the real answer to that particular question is, no, not everything. Only the stuff in your bank account.
Right.
But it makes a point, and the point is that when you give somebody a durable power of attorney, they can take everything.
Mm-hmm.
They have access to your retirement accounts, to your real estate, to your savings, brokerage accounts, etc. So it is a little scary that you give somebody this authority. And some people, because they don't want any issues about it being in effect, you know, am I or am I not incompetent in the event that that emergency arises, they don't want there to potentially be a delay or a hitch in establishing mm-hmm. that. They'll say, well, look, I'm just going to put it in effect immediately. I know it's my son or my daughter. I know they're fine with it, and they're not going to act on this till they should.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't express a disagreement with that if it's somebody you truly trust, but it's just for you to enter into that or to reach that conclusion, knowing that this means that this person has this power immediately.
Okay.
They don't have to wait till you're incompetent. They
right.
can do it. They can take control of anything immediately.
It better be somebody you do trust.
Yeah. But I want people to get it, why this is so important. You know, here's one way to think about durable powers of attorney, is that, you know, we collectively as a society, we've decided that when someone's under age 18, we're not going to give them the benefit of the doubt. As a matter of fact, we're going to assume that they're not competent to make important decisions. So we often don't let them buy firearms.
Right.
They can only marry under very limited specific conditions, they enter into contracts, you know, a variety of other things. Because we figure that when you're under 18, you're probably incompetent, and the law just assumes that. Well, when you reach 18, then we conclude the opposite. You know, the assumption is that anybody above 18 is competent until they're shown to be otherwise. So things are going along fine, but then imagine the situation when suddenly you have these people who, more often than not, it's due to aging, and
mm-hmm.
when this issue comes up. So maybe they're 70, 75, 80 years old, or 90, whatever the age is, and they're not competent.
Right.
They don't have the ability to make those decisions. Well, they're still wandering around with that assumption in their favor in our society and in the economy. So they can buy things on credit, they can drive cars and maybe when they shouldn't, and they can travel and make all these decisions that would potentially harm them or somebody else.
Right. And people even target the elderly. They target people, scammers or people that want to call, they'll call and catch someone who's lonely, and all of a sudden they're getting their bank account, their bank information. And
yeah, they are a target. I mean, people spot them as very vulnerable, mm-hmm. just like a child would be.
Mm-hmm.
So here is the reason you have durable powers of attorney, is that if this person is wandering around this way and somebody decides to intervene, which hopefully happens. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look at street people, I sometimes wonder, is this an example of someone who they became incompetent and right. yet there was no family member, no one who was motivated mm-hmm. to take an action to have a guardian appointed or conservator appointed? And that is the law's answer to that situation. So if you don't do a durable power of attorney and you, in fact, become incompetent, one possibility is you just wander around as this perpetual victim.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you have some people to watch after you. Maybe you don't.
Right.
But the more common approach in that scenario is someone goes to court and they get an order of protection, or not an order of protection. They'll get a conservatorship or a guardianship created. Now, there may be an order of protection as a piece of this, but the guardianship is intended to appoint someone to take care of their physical person. You know, that person's job is to address their physical needs, their safety, their health. And then there's another person, and it could be the same, who's appointed to be a conservator. If you think about it, a conservator's skill set's going to be a little different from mm-hmm. that of a guardian. A conservator is somebody who manages the assets,
right.
you know, who protects the assets, who pays the bills, who manages the estate, so to speak. So that's the law's answer, is if there is no power of attorney in effect, and if someone gets to a point where they're a threat to themselves or others, someone would go to court, often a family member, and ask the court to make this appointment. The reason you don't want to have it handled that way are lots of reasons, actually. Mm-hmm. It's expensive. It's time-consuming. It requires that, you know, lawyers be paid. Doctors come and testify, so there's hearing.
Because you have to prove that they're incompetent at that point, is that right?
Oh, yeah, it's not casually done. I mean, right. the law takes that very seriously. So there's a formal hearing, mm-hmm. there's testimony, there's a guardian ad litem appointed to represent the alleged incompetent person. So it's a big deal, and it takes time. And once the appointment is made, then the court oversees the administration thereafter. So you have a guardian and a conservator, each of whom are reporting back to the court. So when you figure when everybody's getting paid through this process and the lapse of time, et cetera, it's just a very clunky, inefficient, expensive way to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So the alternative is that you can create a durable power of attorney by which you decide who at least manages all those things in the world that you own, and they can step in immediately to make many decisions on your behalf that you can't make. And similar thing with the durable power of attorney for healthcare. So these are important items, and they're relatively inexpensive. I mean, the durable power of attorney, while there are forms out there that you can buy, I'm sure, for less than $100.
Probably online.
Yeah, you can even go to the ABA website, and there's a form that you can download that's a durable power of attorney that's been approved by the Missouri statute. The reason I don't encourage that for clients is it is a form, and it's like getting a pair of shoes from a North Korean shoe factory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they come in one size. And you can imagine what size that is. It's big enough to fit everybody, which means it fits very few people correctly.
Right.
So that's kind of the problem with these forms, is that people have very specific concerns and ideas about what authority they want these people to have and when. And when they simply sign a form, then often that doesn't represent what they want. Maybe better than nothing, but it's rarely exactly what they want.
Well, and I think people get stuck on this word estate. They hear the word estate and think, I have to have a lot of money, or I really don't need to have a lawyer. I really don't have enough to even worry about. Well, you really do, because just like what you were saying, you want your wishes carried out. You want it to be what you want it to be. You want not some big box store kind of a form.
Yeah, yeah. But what's tempting about those forms is they're cheap.
Right.
So we're going to take a break. We'll be right back in a minute, and we'll move to what's item number 3 on my list of critical components of a wonderful senior plan.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors, presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. And now, attorney CPA, Joe Cordell.
All right, we're back with this countdown, critical components of a wonderful senior plan. Now, Susan, we've talked about what I think are probably the most urgent, and incidentally, they're really the most inexpensive of the components of this plan.
So why are we putting them off?
Exactly. And it's because we don't think they're urgent.
Right.
But really, these are the things that I think should be in place first. And the good news is they're probably the fastest and they're the cheapest. So number one was some sort of advanced care directive. That can be a durable power of attorney for health care. It can be a living will, surrogate decision-making authority, it's called in some states. So in any case, that was item number one. Number two, durable power of attorney. Hugely powerful, hugely important, and yet cheap. Cheap and potentially very fast. So these are things that there's no excuse for people not having in place. So what do we go to? Item number three. I listed as number three. I was torn between will or trust for number three. And I decided that I would go with living trust. And the reason is that whenever you have a trust in place, it allows you to cover lots of other things that you need during your lifetime. So a trust is not just something, I'm going to do to take care of my kids and my grandkids. It's really something that's relevant to you today if you become incompetent in that scenario. But now keep in mind, when people talk about trust, you really need to ask them, are they talking about a revocable trust or an irrevocable trust? And the irrevocable trust is a serious step because, as the name implies, it means it's not revocable, but it does have a lot of power. And here's kind of a trade-off to think about. If you're wanting to protect your assets, and you may want to protect your assets in the context of long-term care planning, for example. That's a classic case. People want to qualify for Medicaid, et cetera. So let's assume you're wanting to develop a plan so you can qualify for Medicaid, you have some assets, and someone says to you, hopefully a very qualified elder lawyer, says to you, well, what you need is an irrevocable living trust. And so you need to understand that that's a trade-off, and here it is. If you're going to have protection from your predators and creditors, that means that you yourself cannot have the same access and use of the funds that you had before. Now, I don't want to spook anybody away with that. It just means that, you know, nothing in life is free.
Right.
So if you have unfettered access to your money so that you can save it, spend it, or give it away, just like you do now, then guess who else does? Creditors and predators. So you have to ask yourself, am I willing to give up some control or have some limitations placed on my access to assets in exchange for qualifying for a benefit that in Medicaid's case can pay, what, 10, 12, however much it is, $10,000 per month or more, which it commonly is.
For nursing home, right?
Yeah, long-term care. It's huge. Mm-hmm. So, and it's not just, of course, nursing home is a big ticket item now for doing asset protection planning, but it can apply in other settings as well. So irrevocable trusts are a serious step. They you shouldn't enter into it lightly, mm-hmm. but don't be unduly afraid that gee, this is something that I definitely don't want to do. Here's what I often find when I have this conversation with clients is that they will say, well, tell me what will be the main restriction I might have. And I might say to them, well, for example, you might not have access to your principal in the same way. You could have your income paid off to you. You could buy and sell assets within a trust, have complete control of managing the trust. But you couldn't write a check to yourself to, for example, go to Florida for 3-week vacation the way you would of the principal. So it is a limitation, because in this example I'm giving you, then you would be saying, all right, I'm willing to give up direct control, or at least the ability to pay the principal to me. And in exchange for that, I'm going to qualify for, you know, whatever my long-term health care expenses might be through Medicaid. And you have to ask yourself, is that a fair transaction? And some people say, well, gee, what if I need that principal? And here's a general rule of thumb, is that if you have it, you probably don't need it. And here's what I mean by that. If you needed it, you would have already spent it.
You're already using it. Yeah.
And the fact that you haven't. But But I know that all of us, especially as we get older, we start thinking, yeah, but what if?
Mm-hmm.
And so I generally know my clients pretty well. And often what they do is they follow each other around the house at night, cutting off the lights behind each other. And
guilty as charged.
Yeah. and they also will tend to save from their income, even though they're not spending their current income. And yet there's this concern that I may want at that principal. So it has to be a judgment call. And there are different kinds of or terms of irrevocable trust. So I don't want to present this as the only condition or option. But that's an example of how an irrevocable trust, you know, you might still be the trustee, which means you would control it. You'd make decisions about investments. You move money around. You may put your house in it. You live in your house as you might otherwise. So in many ways, things don't change. But in some ways, they have to. And that only makes sense if you're saying that because of this trust, you should be protected from creditors and predators.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be some real surrender of a benefit, so to speak.
And so then the trust would, the principal, let's go back to your example, the principal would then be transferable to your children at some point because the money's still there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
then you no longer have unlimited access to it so that you can qualify for Medicaid.
Yeah. And here's what's interesting, though, Susan, is you can still access the money for others. So what's cool is that you can give your money away.
So you could gift it.
Yeah, you can gift it to anybody on the planet except
yourself.
Yourself. That's right. So in some clients I explain this to, and they just immediately perk up and say, well, I get that. I mean, why would someone not think that this is a fair thing or a perfectly reasonable thing to do? You know, sign me up. And then others, you know, I can tell as I'm explaining this to them, I'm watching their body language. I know they're thinking, yeah, but what if?
I might want to go to Florida. I might want to, I might need it. I think that's the thing. Most of us don't go, I just want to go to Florida.
No.
I think most people are concerned about, well, what if I need it? What if I get sick? What if I have a big hospital bill? Those types of questions.
And the good news is, if you get sick or you have a hospital bill, that's the reason you've done it.
Yeah, exactly.
But still, and I think you said it well, Susan. People think, what if I need it? They're not mm-hmm. thinking I may decide I want to take it and go to Paris for a month.
Right.
They're thinking, you know, what if something are, but if you ask them, what would that something be? They don't know, but it's possible it could be there. So I don't want to be too critical, incidentally. I get it. You know, anytime that you surrender any bit of control over all your assets, then I can see how that can make some people pause and think.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an irrevocable trust. Now let's shift and talk about a revocable trust. A revocable trust is an easy decision, certainly should be. And that means that you create this thing called a trust. You put your assets in it, but you still have complete control. You've surrendered no control. You're the person who transfers the assets, which is called a grantor. I don't want to get bogged down in the lingo here, but it helps to know a few terms. So the grantor or the settlor is the person that creates it. That's you and your spouse, perhaps. And then you have to appoint somebody to run it. That's also you. You know, so you're the trustee. You and or your spouse will make decisions about, you know, how money's used and whatnot. And then you have a beneficiary. And remember, the beneficiary is the reason this thing is created. At least that's the idea behind a trust. And guess what? You're the beneficiary. So with beneficiaries, you can have layers. And so whenever people are doing estate planning, they'll more often than not, if we're talking about irrevocable trusts, and many times with revocable and irrevocable, many times a beneficiary will be either the client or the spouse. And then they'll have a next generation. So in the event that they become incompetent when they die, and that would be the triggering event when they pass, then there would be a next generation or next tier of benefits, of beneficiaries. And then that can go on indefinitely. So that's the reason you hear the phrase sometimes use a dynasty trust, because now that's legal. It wasn't at one time. Used to, you know, there were strict rules about trusts that went on indefinitely. And now, for the most part, you can get close to indefinitely. And the nice thing about that is you can reach down and benefit and serve generations beyond those you may directly know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this will depend in part, of course, I get it, that if you have $100,000 in assets, maybe you're not going to get past the next generation or maybe your grandkids. But for those who may have 500, a million, who knows? Remember, a period of time, money won't be coming out of this. It'll be growing.
Right.
In other words, you'll be earning money on this. So don't assume that, gee, I have $500,000. That's not enough to benefit my great-grandkids in addition to my grandkids and my kids. But don't assume that, because there could be long periods of 20 years in which money's accumulating, waiting for example, your grandkids, your great-grandkids to go to college.
Now, does the trustee change over time? I mean, if obviously you're the initial trustee and then you pass away, and let's say it goes to your children as the next layer, but at some point, if this were going to go on indefinitely, you'd need someone else to become the new trustee. How does that work?
Yeah, and that's what's really cool about this, is that think about the trustee and the beneficiary, the two people that two of the three figures involved in creating a trust or a trust operation. So is that in each case you have successors, they call them. So you have one, two, three, four. These are my preferences. And so there's always someone else to step in. So, you know, if you have a trust that's going on for generations, you unless you have somebody who has, you know, pretty long life, then they're going to be succeeded by maybe two other trustees. And if you don't have a person to name, you can empower the last trustee to identify the next one and then put down what your criteria would be. You know, a person of integrity, a Christian, whatever your criteria are, you can specify that so that you don't have to think of the person yourself at that time. You can trust that the trustee you did name will make that selection.
Will make a wise choice.
Yeah. And with beneficiaries, you know, again, it's a similar thing. You have one tier, and then when they pass away, you have another tier. And you get to choose the rules. And I can tell you that I'm a big, big advocate of never just paying the money out to a beneficiary. That's virtually always a mistake. And the reason it is that you can do so much more for them by keeping it in the trust. You can provide all the income be paid out to them. You can provide that any urgent needs be met. You can provide for their education. In other words, you can put in terms that in no way causes them to be deprived of the benefit. And yet at the same time, by doing it that way, you've protected them from the impact of lawsuits, from divorce. And I'm an authority on this subject, Cordell and Cordell.
I've heard that, yeah.
Yeah. I can tell you that, you know, Cordell and Cordell has, 250 lawyers around the country and in the UK. And I can tell you that our lawyers are trained to figure out ways that money that was given to the wife by her parents or her grandparents is deemed marital by the divorce court.
Oh, yeah.
There's always a misstep that's made. And it's very difficult to dot every I and cross every T to assure that that money that you inherit or is given to you by your family doesn't become a marital asset. And you know, when I think about this as it applies to me, I have two daughters, and they're both in college. And for me to think about this person, that this person would probably be the person on the planet I would like least, getting half of everything that I've worked and saved for to give to my daughter, however much or little that is.
Right.
And I think people should think about that, and not just in the context of their children, but their grandchildren and their great-grandkids.
Right.
And so the good news is you can easily give them all the benefits you want to give them and yet not turn over the money in such a way to where it becomes a marital asset. So there's protection from creditors, lawsuits, ex-spouses or divorce. There's qualification for benefits. By not giving them the money outright, then guess what? The kids of your children, your grandkids, will now be eligible for financial aid and other things that they would not have otherwise been eligible for college.
Well, and there are all kinds of research that just talks about whenever someone receives a large amount of money, it's often a big challenge for them to even manage it effectively. And so by not getting a whole huge lump sum, there's the tax benefits and all those other types of things. But a lot of times people just don't know how to handle it. And so this is a way to protect your kids from themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're right. We all have read those statistics, you know, when you get a lot of money, you know, often things don't go well.
Right.
And if you have a son or a daughter or a grandchild that, you know, maybe a bit of a spendthrift, then you've not done them any favors. So So money paid out directly like that, yeah, there's a chance that the child themselves will misuse it. Often you see investments made where with the best of intentions, and not necessarily a reckless child, but just not having the right judgment. And so they end up having to file bankruptcy because of investment in businesses. I can't tell you how many times I've seen that over the years, mm-hmm. you know, where they inherit some money, and so they figure, I need to do something with this that is wise. And so someone suggests to them they buy a business, and they do, and they don't know how to run the business.
And it sounds good on paper.
And so it's just not good. And then keep in mind also qualification for long-term care mm-hmm. and disabilities. Sometimes when I'm speaking to audiences on the subject of planning, I'll ask the question. I say, how many of you have disabled heirs or beneficiaries? And you know, maybe a few hands will go up in the room. But then I point out to them, you know, it's really a trick question, because you don't really know if you're going to have disabled mm-hmm. heirs or beneficiaries. You just don't know. Ask me today. I don't have any. Talk to me next week. Not yeah. to mention, talk to me in 10 years.
Right.
I mean, life, you know, sometimes throws us curves. And the good news is, if you have a trust created, you don't have to anticipate the possibility that that's going to happen. Because if it does happen and those beneficiaries have any money, they're not qualified for any state or federal benefits
right.
that they would otherwise be qualified for.
Right.
So these are all reasons, again, never, never, never just hand out money to people you love through an inheritance when you can do it through a trust. Back in a moment.
You're listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors. Presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. And now, attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Well, we're back. We're working down our list of really just five items, Susan. I feel like I should have 25 on this list, but I wanted to think of, you know, what are those core critical items mm-hmm. that I can tell people that you may not have done this other stuff, but these are the things you really got to get around to as you pass that age 60, for example. You know, when you're looking at that last third of your life, I mean, there are some things that definitely need to be in place for you to be safe and for your plan to be safe.
And I think safety is what we all want to have. I mean, that is one of the key components that we all want, is we want to have safety. And by just doing a little bit of planning, we're going to have that.
Yeah, but, you know, we all think we can postpone it.
We do.
And I get that. And that's one of the challenges of elder lawyers is that often the people who call and come in to see are people who've already had a crisis develop.
Mm-hmm.
Because who wants to talk about the unpleasant topic of what if I need long-term care? You know, what about when I die? What happens to my stuff? It's the sort of thing you'd rather postpone.
Right.
And too many people do it. So this is a challenge to you listening to this show. We know our audience. Our audience tends to be people who are interested in practical solutions. I mean, that's whenever we put together subjects every week, our purpose is to identify things that will be of interest and value to our audience. And we assume our audience is above age 60. Those of you listening to us that are under that, please don't go away. It'll apply to you sooner or later. And much of it will apply to you now.
Well, and again, be prepared, be thinking about it. You probably have a relative who's going to end up in this situation as well.
Yeah. And I would add that even if you're under 60, these items would be applicable to anybody at any point, just so you know. The reason I'm focusing on them as it pertains to people when they get older is that obviously these deadlines are approaching. But any of you listening, take note. And if you're whatever your age is, it's a wonderful thing to have these in place. Next item. And this on my list, and I only have five items that I jotted down here as things that I thought were most important. The next item is a will. Now, wills, many people are under the assumption that, gee, if I have this thing called a will, then I avoid probate.
Mm-hmm.
I need to have a will so I can avoid probate.
Right.
And it's ironic that actually probate was created for wills. and now you also have probate if you don't have a will, but you don't want that option. That means where you have nothing. And so the alternative to that is you have a will, and probate will address that. Now, I don't want to confuse you. Yes, trust can allow you to avoid those things associated with probate, But first, let me explain a will, and then I'll tie it in with a trust. And you notice I listed the trust first in order of priority. But
is it a better option for most people?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And I won't say for everybody, because you could have so few assets that it just wouldn't make sense. So I know some lawyers argue, some estate planning lawyers argue that, you know, trusts are oversold, meaning that sometimes people who have very little assets, you know, are encouraged to get a trust. And a trust on average is going to cost you more than a will. I mean, you can, let's forget a will form, and let's assume you have a real will done that represents, you know, your priorities, and you can create, lay out your plan, kind of like we've talked about today. So by that definition, you know, expect to spend $200 to $500 on a will, a real will, okay, where it represents your values and your goals. And contrast that to a trust. I mean, I hate to mention numbers because it varies widely, but you'll spend $1,000, I'm pretty confident, for a revocable living trust. So why would people do that? Well, if you only have, you know, maybe, I hate to grab a number, but maybe if you have less than $50,000 in assets, you might not decide to do a living trust. But even then, as I say that, I'm thinking, well, then what will be paid? Well, you can do small estate administration. So as I think this through, I don't deal a lot. Let me issue this disclaimer. I don't deal a lot with small estate administration. I mean, okay. most of my clients are not wealthy, but they don't have less than, I think, $50,000.
Isn't a house included as part of their estate?
It is. So it would be.
A house in most areas is going to be $50,000 to $100,000 at least.
So it's very easy to spill over. And so, but yet I get it that some people may have very few assets, and maybe there are certain other reasons I won't get into to what those various things might be, where somebody says, look, I want a will, I don't want a trust. But the good news is having a will is better than having nothing. Because when you have nothing, then the state decides who gets what. And rarely is that going to be exactly what you would have decided who should get what. So let's talk about a will. A will is where you state that you want to appoint someone who is called an executor or a personal representative. This is somebody you want to appoint, and their job is to hand out your stuff to the people that you've identified in the way that you've identified. Now, when we mentioned trust a while ago, at the risk of completely confusing you, I'm trying to keep this as simple as possible. There is a thing called a testamentary trust. And a testamentary trust is a trust that's created in your will. So it doesn't have any impact on your life whatsoever. It doesn't exist until you're dead. And then when you're dead, if you want to create a testamentary trust to do some of the things we talked about for the people you care about, you know, to protect the money, to not hand it out, to have a trustee, everything I described before the break, you can do in a testamentary trust. It just doesn't give you any benefits during your lifetime.
Almost like an addendum.
Yeah. It's something that was intended only to help others when you're gone. Right. It doesn't help you when you're alive.
Right.
So that's a testamentary trust. So a will can have that. But the will, the job of the personal representative, and this is the person that's the phrase used in the statute now rather than executor. The personal representative, their job is to assure that ultimately the people that you wanted to get the stuff gets it in the way that they should get it. Now, they have another responsibility, though, first, and that's that before they hand out any money, they have to identify creditors. And so when people hear that cheap probate takes a year, or can they hear stories where it took a number of years, and they're thinking, you know, why is that necessary? And when you think about what all is going on, it's not difficult to understand why it would take at least 6 months, which it does by statute, at least 6 months, and more often closer to a year. But what is happening is that someone filed this will with the courthouse. Remember, that has to be done, so it's filed with the probate court. Once that's done, if there's the proper certifications and authentication, then the executor or personal representative will have the job of marshaling the assets. That means assembling all the assets, identifying where they are, you know, so they own land and where, and and can you give me an address on that? I need to get a copy of a deed. And do, you know, they own personal property. Let me go in and have someone do an inventory. So first they have to identify what is there out there that's in this thing called, you know, Bill Smith's estate. And so once they've identified all those things, then they have to publish in some fashion to let claimants or creditors know that this person has died. These assets are about to be distributed to other people. So if you have a claim against this person, you need to step forward. And that advertisement process by statute will last 6 months. So you have the appointment of the guardian, and then you'll have a period of, or the appointment of the personal representative, and then you'll have a period in which, you know, there will be some sort of public notification, usually in a legal periodical, which you might argue no one reads that anyway. So how would a creditor know? But the theory is, you know, that constitutes notice.
Right.
So after this ad runs for this period of time, then at that point, the personal representative can pay out the money with the court's approval, and then they provide an accounting to the court. Now, remember, this only goes even as smoothly as I just described, only if there's no contest. Mm-hmm. If somebody steps forward and says, I don't think this will's accurate, or more commonly, I think that Uncle Bill was influenced unduly, it's called undue influence or coercion or fraud, that while he did sign this document, it doesn't represent his true wishes. Mm-hmm. So all those things can happen. So there are ways in which a will can go sideways. However, is it a good idea to have a will if you don't have a trust? Certainly. And in some cases, it may make sense to have a will and not a trust. And I don't want to be on the record saying everyone needs a trust, just so that's clear to the listeners. I do think the vast majority of listeners should have a trust. It's better to spend a little more money on it and avoid this delay. And incidentally, everybody's getting paid in what I just described.
Right.
There are fees filed at the courthouse. The personal representative is entitled to compensation by statute. A lawyer that's been appointed for the estate will get compensation by statute. Those percentages are laid out, and they can add up quickly.
And it's all reducing the size of the estate.
Yeah. So here's the ironic thing is that the lawyer will be paid for from the assets of the person doing the estate planning. And we can assume that these are not going to be the last, you know, the last $1,000 in the estate. So this money will always be used. And the question is, why not go ahead and use it now so right. that your heirs get a whole lot more versus their having their inheritance reduced by $10,000 or mm-hmm. 15 or 20. And while I don't do personally, I don't do a lot of probate. Most of my clients don't need it, or at least it's not a process that I handle personally. But I mean, I understand that there's a place for wills. And even when you do a trust, I should add this. Even if you do your planning with trusts, you should be sure that your elder law attorney has done, and he or she will, has done what's called a pour-over will. And a pour-over will, as the name implies, is simply a document that assures that anything you didn't put in your trust, remember we were talking about the trust a while ago and you put assets in it?
Mm-hmm.
If you don't put those assets in your trust, then when you die, guess what? The trust doesn't control them. You have to be sure and retitle those things. And we don't have time today to get into this as time's running out, except for me to call your attention to that if you create a trust, be sure you fund it. That's the word that's used. Be sure you fund your trust. You transfer assets into it. But let's assume there are some things you chose not to put into it. It's not disastrous. And the reason it's not is that you'll have what's called a pour-over will. And its purpose exists only to catch anything that wasn't in your trust. Sure, it'll go through a sort of probate, but better than being missed. And the instructions in your will is to dump it in your trust.
Okay.
So it's called a pour-over will. We have a little bit of time left, Susan. Let me try to give at least, I'll give a very quick mention of the fifth item, and maybe we can circle back and do this in
sure.
the next 3 weeks.
Sure.
Long-term care. Now, long-term care deserves at least a show.
It does.
So it's kind of fitting that we have this as our fifth item, is that we can call your attention to long-term care planning. It definitely deserves to be on your five most important urgent steps. And yet it's something that people will have different solutions for. Some will be in a position to buy insurance. Some will be in a position to retain an elder law attorney who will allow them to qualify for Medicaid coverage, which means all those costs are taken care of in that way. I wish I could talk a lot more about long-term care, but, you know, kind of the nature of of this.
Radio does have a time limit. Yeah,
it does. You know, you can't spill over like you can in other things in life.
No, we don't have a pour over show or anything.
Hey, now that's a concept. Okay, Susan, that's it. Well, we made it through the five.
We did.
And I think that people can follow up and get more information if they need it. We look forward to getting together with you guys again next week with another interesting and helpful show.
You've been listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. That's eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.